Get me for free. Courtesy of Yelp for Restaurant. Tools and tactics are what's going to make you successful in 2024. Yelp for Restaurants has the tools you need to scale your restaurant this year, and I'm here to help. Sign up for a consultation with Yelp Guest Manager and get a free one-hour coaching session with me. In our session, we'll dive deep into your restaurant and build the blueprint to overcome your current obstacles and scale your profitability. You can sign up for both free sessions by simply going to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp today. I'll see you soon. Now here we go.
The very first service you should be providing is hospitality, meaning you're making someone feel welcome in your business or want to be a patron in that business. Kindness counts, and kindness is currency both to your team, to your support workers, and to your guests.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. Travis Talbot is a Renaissance man who's dedicated his life to learning and teaching. Far from the day-to-day grind of restaurant life, the chef travels the world, immersing himself in new cultures and cuisines for the benefit of his clients. We may not all aspire to be jet setters, but we are here to learn, and Travis does not disappoint, sharing the tools and strategies he's used to improve his life and the lives of restaurant owners globally.
Well, it's actually the family business that goes back a lot further than that. So my mom was in the industry, which is how we got into it, my brother and I, which nowadays I think there's child labor laws against that stuff. But we were mopping floors and stocking shelves and working in dish pits by the age of 9, that kind of stuff. I was bartending by the age of 12, right? So that was kind of where it all came from. It's in our family DNA. And then on the other side of my family, which were all cowboys, when I used to spend my summers following the rodeos with my grandparents and uncles, I was the assigned cook and the assigned bartender for all these rodeos. And so kind of this, you know, even though it was a different world, it was still doing hospitality. And then literally I put myself through school, through university, high school, even like I left home fairly early through some stories there. But I put myself through high school, had my own apartment and was working as a bartender and a waiter when I was 15. And then university, working as a doorman, getting into the nightclub scene. So it's kind of been in the DNA. Like I've only ever had 2 jobs my entire life, one being hospitality. And then for a while there, when I was trying to play cowboy, and I was terrible at that. All right.
So through that process, you've been able to extricate yourself from day-to-day operations, which isn't true for everybody. How did that path start?
Similar to your story, Josh, is I kind of rose to the top at a very young age. By the time I was 26, I was overseeing 30 food and beverage operations as the vice president of operations for a hospitality group on the West Coast. Running nightclubs, working with House of Blues, hanging out behind the velvet ropes and in all the private rooms and stuff. And then I went and made the mistake of doing a few of my own operations. You know, I went and did my own nightclub and my own restaurants and realized I wasn't as cool as I thought I was and learned a lot of lessons the hard way, a lot of financial lessons the hard way. And then I got into corporate. I ended up working as the executive vice president for a casino group out of Canada, overseeing 20 plus casinos, all food, beverage, entertainment. I took a little bit of another angle at hospitality at one point in time where we were hiring, we're working with all these PR agencies and marketing agencies to build up brands and build up our chefs' brands and names. So I decided I would go see what's behind those curtains. And so I spent a couple of years in PR marketing in the hospitality side. And then I went back to the corporate world And then just prior to COVID, like you were saying earlier, we were talking, I just wasn't digging it. I just wasn't feeling the passion. I felt like we were just creating these homogenized, everyday products that didn't have anything to them. We very rarely had a conversation about the guest, or when culture came up, it was something for the HR department to handle and wasn't something we were supposed to be participants in. So I just eventually decided, I'm like, I think there's another angle that I should be pursuing at this. And I didn't want to go back to owning. I didn't want to go back to operating. And like you said, doing the day-to-day operations and in at 8 a.m, out at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. So I kind of just got together with some friends and just said, hey, what do you think I should do? Like, I was literally looking for a lifeline from somebody. Everyone's like, you've got a lot to share. And even if it's just your stories and your experiences, you should get out there and help some people. So I decided to, you know, great timing, mind you. So opened up a little bit of a consulting group, got my brother on board, which his wife is really pleased about 6 months into COVID. Grabbed a bunch of people I knew from my travels and my locations, living in different locations, working different operations. Grabbed some guys that were top shelf pros from the casino industry, and we opened up a little consulting group. And then started off, our focus was resorts, boutique hotels, resorts, and primarily ski resorts, and mostly in food and beverage. And then we were about to expand into beach resorts. We were about to go exotic. And then the curtain came crashing down, right? I pivoted, and now we have a smaller team. We can scale up to almost anything we need to do. And it's more about my Rolodex now than it is about the team sitting in an office waiting to be deployed, right?
So let's get back to the ego, because I think that there are a lot of valuable lessons there. One way to look at ego is to say that I'm doing what I want, which isn't necessarily a bad thing if you're willing to travel to a market that wants what you want to give. But what we're really talking about there, and the root of it is ego, but it's product market fit. In, I would say, 25% of the consulting work that I do, it's not a new customer acquisition issue. It's not an awareness issue. It's not a customer frequency issue. It's a product market fit issue. It's that what they are serving to this market is not what this market is ravenous for.
That's a really good analogy, yeah.
Right, because you've also seen, right, we see it today. There are really mediocre concepts that have achieved product market fit in a big way, and all ills are forgiven by excellent product market fit. And so when you go in, I would assume that it's one of the first things that you analyze, whether you call it out as that or not, is product market fit. And if that's the case, what does that process look like for you? Because I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there that are wondering, does the community know about me? And have they voted that this isn't right? Or is it an awareness issue? How do you distill out if it's a product market fit issue?
Well, I think that the very first thing is there an actual back to the plan? Is who is this for? What deliverables are you creating for what audience? How are you going to reach them? And is this what they're asking for? Like, you and I have in our travels, I go into, there's a whole list of places I have in my bookmarks. I'm like, remember this restaurant? Remember this place? Dynamite designers, unbelievable spaces and locations, and they'd all shit the bed, right? And so first thing that we always look at is, what is your offering? In fact, one of the things we look at nowadays, and with AI, it's making life a little bit better, but you know, you still have to have the context and have the insight on track, is so many people can't put into a sentence what their restaurant is. What kind of food are you putting in your mouth? What's the vibe? What's the experience? And that word experience, we can dive into it later, but what's the experience you're hoping to impart? So you have to start there. I was always brought up to say that your audience is an audience of one. So you're opening the door tomorrow. What's your mom? What are you serving your mom tomorrow morning to show her how you put this all together and what you bring in, what your vision is? So that's the first thing. And then we talk about ego. Maybe another better word for that is just about your malleability. How willing are you to veer off a little course off your original vision? How willing are you to take input and then acknowledge feedback? So, so many people are like, I'm like, where's your market study? And that's more on the corporate side. And they're like, oh, we don't know. We're bringing something new to market. I'm like, you still have to know what's out there. You still have to know what the demographics are. You still have to know what your comp set is. You guys can't just come in and say, we're awesome and everyone's going to show up, right? So definitely the product, but then coming to the understanding of why that product, does it fit the theme? You and I have gone through millions of menus. I'm like, okay, so we're in Thailand and you're serving Canadian comfort food. Explain to me how that fits your model, how that fits the guest's understanding of why they're coming in. There's a lot of variables in that. But for me, it's just like, what's the why behind it before we even get into the how? And if you don't know the why and you can't articulate it, it doesn't matter what PR firm you picked up. It doesn't matter how much of a wizard that your 18-year-old kid is on TikTok that's going to handle all your marketing if you can't articulate and define what you are and who it's for, right?
Well, something that you brought up that I think is a worthwhile conversation is total addressable market, is what we would call it in marketing, is are there enough of the people that you're trying to serve to facilitate the size of your restaurant, the overall overhead? I think it's something we think a lot about. When I opened a dive bar in Hollywood, it was a large total addressable market, but also they would come back with frequency. There's a lot of frequency when you're at a lower price point, right? So I had no idea when I got into fine dining, unfortunately for me, how big the total addressable market needed to be. It needs to be massive, because when people are spending $125 a person, they're not coming back every week. They're not coming back every month. So the number of customers is massive.
Number of customers, and I think you nailed a really good point, is what level do you need to execute at that you're going to be able to impress and capture that $125 to $150 per head? That's a tall order nowadays. Whereas if you went a little bit more mainstream, a little bit more casual, made yourself a little bit accessible to a larger audience, yeah, you may be only getting $45 to $50 a head, but that person's or that circle of that social circle's coming in. I used to work for one guy, Richards on Richards, which was like the Studio 54 of Canada at the time. And he said, listen, I'll take the blue collar worker every day over the black Amex card. And he goes, the expectations are easier to meet. It's easier to impress. And then there's loyalty and frequency out of that. So back to what you were talking about is know your market, know your audience and what you're delivering. And also whether you're capable. I see so many people that are watching, you know, Food Network, or they're totally dedicated to Marco Pierre White's YouTube channel, and they're going to create a Michelin starred restaurant. I'm like, okay, are you capable of that? Do you understand what goes into that more than a 30 minutes, a cook's tour kind of thing on TV? Are you capable? Are you ready to get married to your business? Are you ready to become obsessive? They don't know what it takes. There's a big difference between Michelin guide and Michelin rated, right?
Absolutely. Something else as it relates to that is like, be careful what you wish for, right? Because I'll give you an example. When we opened Prue and Proper in downtown LA, it was fine dining. We were super excited. And we said, we're going to own the Cajun and Creole market. I was born and raised in Southern Louisiana. I think that this is a great niche for us. And we did. But as it turns out, in Los Angeles, capturing and cannibalizing that entire market, it was like 72 people. It wasn't enough to sustain a 6,000 square foot, two-story restaurant. And so to speak to one of your points from firsthand experience, we had to broaden the market. We went from Cajun and Creole to Southern, cannibalized that market, realized that market wasn't big enough either, and then went into New American, right? American Classics reimagined. And at that point, we had a large enough market that we could actually functionally run the restaurant because the audience was large enough. And we did it without alienating the first two groups. But that was a year-long process.
That's a lot of course corrections, and that's a lot of stress. That's a lot of investment of resources to kind of, okay, we got to make a course correction again. Okay, we got to shift back a little bit the other way. And I think a lot of that can be avoided if you were to sit down and have the hard conversations up front. Show me your plan. Who's your audience? Why are you doing this? Can you execute it? Have you done any market research? Show me a like model. And this is one of the things, and I think I listened to a couple of your podcasts where a number of the people you were interviewing were like, it's all out there. The information is so readily available now, as opposed to, I don't remember, which maybe we're going back in the day. So if I was to come to your restaurant back when I was still getting into the game, I'd be stealing a menu, or I'd be stuffing put it in my girlfriend's purse, or stuff it in the back of your shirt. But now it's just so much information available that it's almost unbelievable that people aren't doing that level of market research to see, is there an appetite for this, right? And I don't want to be the first mover in any of that stuff. I don't want to be the head of the pack. I want to come in the middle of the pack and take the majority of the audience. I don't want to be out there scouting for it, right?
100%, because it always works out to be one of, and this is true with almost any entrepreneurial venture. But when I opened the bar in Hollywood, this was 2010. So this was at the peak of nightclubs in LA, actually almost at the start of the decline because of the 2008 recession. And so people needed a place to go. And so I was like, let's open this New Orleans inspired dive bar. And I can so vividly remember my business partner turning to me and he goes, there's nothing like this in the market. And I said, Mark, either we're geniuses or we're idiots.
Or we're going to grind.
We're about to, right. Yeah. And we'll find out real quick. And it worked. So it turned out that we were geniuses that time. But I would never want to do that again. To go back to your original point, because I think it's worth hammering home, modeling. Prue and Proper was something entirely original, but eventually, in its most successful version, was modeled after Redbird, Neil Frazier's new American classic restaurant in downtown LA. He was the only one in my contemporary set, so we mimicked his positioning, we mimicked his messaging, we mimicked his hours of operation, because he had been around for 5 years longer than we had. He had already figured it out.
And we have that conversation all the time, is tell me what you want. And a lot of what we do sometimes is, a lot, all the time, is we'll find models that we serve as aspirational models. We'll do the research. And a lot of times people say comp set, they look at something that's within a 10 block radius or a 5 mile radius. Well, we're like, well, hold on. We found this operator in Chicago that has a similar model to you. Or, hey, we found this place in France. Not all of it's transferable, but man, oh man, have you guys got a very similar vision as to decor, vibe, some of the menu items? But that's all out there now. It's just, there's so many good, and else you don't need to recreate the wheel. For as cliche as that is, someone out there is doing what you want to do or done it exceptionally well, or has kind of cut the path to make it easier for you. And it's amazing how many people in the restaurant business and hospitality business just want to make it hard, right? They just want to, like, no, it's got to be my way. I'm like, we can put your fingerprints all over this. We can do all your dishes nuanced to your vision, but you got to start with some core. You have to have some underpinning that's stable, right?
Let's talk about executive development, because I know that one of the arms of your consultancy is executive development, both within the industry and outside of the industry, which I think is really interesting. What does that look like? Because I would argue that every problem within our businesses, not only are we ultimately responsible for, but in large part, we're also the cause of, either through action or inaction. And so that being the case, personal improvement is professional improvement. So for those that are unfamiliar with executive development in a granular way, how would you describe what it is?
Well, we look at executive development as basically healthy conversations. Because a lot of executives, first of all, when they're in a boardroom, time is of the essence and time is short and they got to rapid fire everything. So they don't really have an opportunity to bounce ideas off of people. They don't have an opportunity to have direct conversations. It's usually pretty linear. It's usually pretty scripted in terms of the sessions that they're having. And they kind of already know what they want the outcome to be for the most part. So what we like to do is say, listen, you have to become a better listener. You have to ask better questions or find a way to ask questions that's not so intimidating or confrontational. And then you also, one of the things we've had our best success with is taking those executives out to be guests in their own properties, as opposed to in the casino business. I work with my boss and he's like, okay, we're going for dinner at such and such a steakhouse. I want to see how the place is operating. I'm like, no, you don't. We're going to sit in the same chair that we always sit in. You're going to request a specific server. They know you're coming, so they've already set the stage and they're already ready for this whole analysis, which isn't an analysis. You're going to order the same thing, even if it's not on the menu. So you're not understanding what the guest experience is like. So there's a big part of that. And a lot of executives just don't have the time, especially if they're at a project of scale or a company of scale. It's like there's that whole boss, undercover boss kind of routine. But I'm like, no, be a guest in your own environment. And then they're like, okay, we see it. We see that's wrong, or we didn't like this part of the experience. I'm like, okay, now the conversation happens. Do you know why that happened? Do you know what led to that? Do you know what the mechanics are behind that faulty mechanism? And do you know how to fix it in terms of how you're going to implement, rather than just writing a memo when we leave here or texting somebody on the fly? So we're finding that the best development is conversational and then real world, getting out. And sometimes, once again, going to the models that make sense. So many of our clients always dine at the same places. They vacation in the same places. They're victims of routine or habit. So we're like, okay, this is your restaurant. We'd like to take you to 4 more restaurants like that. Now tell us, what do you see? And tell us what you know. What do you feel in terms of the service level, the ambiance? And then we can then know where to coach them and say, okay, you need to learn more about service etiquette. You need to understand more about, when we have this conversation all the time these days, about how music affects the environment, how music affects the purchasing, how music affects the memories. And they're like, I didn't know all that stuff. So then we start teaching them on their own business, so to speak, right?
So is that for the independents that are listening? Is that the advice you would give them, is to dine out if they want to be better?
You know what? The best education I ever had, when I worked for one operator, he was like, I'm going to pay you shit. And I'm like, right on. That's a good conversation. And you go, he goes, however, he goes, I will invest in anything that you want to do education wise. And this is back in the day when your suppliers on the booth side, they could pay for stuff like that. He goes, I'll pay for all your education. And he says, and I'm going to give you $1,200 a month for R&D. And I'm like, what? Really? That's the time. It was a lot of money. It was more than my salary. And he's like, get out there. And he says, and when you go out, don't look for all the things that are wrong. He goes, any asshole can pick something apart. He says, pick out the nuances, the things that are like really detail oriented that are making everything right. So are they using better ingredients? Have they got, you know, did they change the playlist 4 times in an hour and a half so that it made sense? Can you identify who the manager is on the floor and what makes him a manager, or actually what makes him a leader? And then also through that is building the network, which I didn't think was part of the exercise. And it definitely wasn't shared that way. But at the time I was living in Vancouver, Canada, and I knew every valet, every doorman, everyone around town. And one day my boss goes, let's drive around town and try some food and to show me some things you've seen that are really cool and show me what's cutting edge and show me what's come fading out. And I knew someone everywhere. And he goes, that was the exercise. He says, now you can see, you can pull from all the best. And in terms of all the best ideas that we can apply, you've built the network. Those people are becoming our customers and our guests, which no one does anymore. You know, it was the original social network. And then he says, we've built up a bit of a reputation that hopefully you weren't an asshole when you're out in all these places. And so that would be my advice to almost any independent operators. You got to get out there. You can't absorb everything you need to absorb just from Instagram and OpenTable and stuff, right?
So I want to talk about education a little bit more, because yes, you can learn independently, or you can hire a coach or a consultant, which I think that in our industry is a minefield. I mean, I had hired consultants for my own businesses and did not have positive experiences, which was one of the reasons it inspired me to get into it as well. And when I was doing background research for the show, I noticed that, and I believe the same thing, that you delineate there's a difference between coaches and consultants.
Oh, yeah.
The similar results, but two very different practices. Can you define for me, in your mind, the difference between coaching and consulting?
Yeah, consulting to me is coming and giving you a roadmap, doing an analysis, identifying the hard problems, and then giving you an option in solutions. Coaching is having the conversations and working with you so that we're empowering you. You're acquiring an education. You're going to then become intuitive and learn the insights that we've learned over the years. So it's more about developing soft skills, acquiring an eye. Another line my brother likes to use, like, did you see what happened over here? Did you see that plate that walked by and see what was wrong with it? And that stuff becomes reflexive. So we're kind of just helping them get their muscles in shape, so to speak, and become a little bit more in tune with their business, where consulting is strictly, they want a concept. They want us to re-engineer the menu. They want to understand what trends are happening. And it's more or less just sharing. It's a brief. I look at consulting like creating a brief, creating a plan, and then helping you determine a course of action. Whereas coaching is about developing an individual to say, okay, eventually, and one of the best lines that I like using is, I like to work myself out of a job here as quickly as possible. All right. So if you're being attentive, if you're embracing change, if you're willing to make some changes and you as an individual and as an operator, then eventually you're going to come in one day and go, Trav, I don't really need you. And I'm like, that's the best line ever, you know, mission accomplished.
What does the blueprint for a successful restaurant look like? We can look at that through the lens of if you and your brother were to open a new restaurant tomorrow, what are the things you would want to have in place? What are the KPIs you'd be tracking?
That's easy. So number one is, what's your plan for people? Everyone uses the word culture nowadays. I'm like, that's just too loose a term nowadays, and it's abused and overused. I'm like, what is your vibe? Like, what's the personality of your venue? And then how do you plan on that venue being a benefit to the people? So there's a group out of Canada, and even during the pandemic, we've all worked for them. We've all had someone who's worked for them over the years. They're quite a massive organization. They've never had a now hiring sign in their windows. They've never had any advertising out there that's on Indeed or on any of those platforms. And they've always got the best staff. So part of that is great leadership. They've definitely got their systems and mechanics down. But the word on the street is you want to go work for those guys. So to me, that's part of the blueprint is how are you going to attract good people? And then how are you going to retain them? And that comes down to being, do you have a likable model, right? Like, are people going to like working for you? Are they going to like telling their friends about what it's like to work there? So that to me is the culture, the personality of the business. I think that's number one. And then sometimes I've seen it where if that model, if you are successful in how you treat your people and how they feel energized to come to work and feel good about the brand and supporting you, you don't have to have an HR department. You don't have to be out there recruiting. Your social media will take care of itself. Your recruitment process will be all in-house. So to me, a successful blueprint starts with how are you going to treat your people? How are you setting up the business model, the financial model, the incentives, all that stuff? And then what's your day-to-day? Where does that people variable fall into the equation? So one of the things I love about traveling, especially I've seen it in Latin America when I was there, definitely I'm seeing a lot in Asia here, is the old school thing of a pre-shift meal, a staff meal, a family meal. That's where culture starts. That's where conversations happen. That's where people get to know each other. And I was always told, if someone ever left this restaurant hungry, how does that make you feel? Are you a good operator if that's your most important guest is your team? And someone left here being hungry. And we had this discussion all the time with operators. I'm like, well, we give them chicken fingers at 40% off. I'm like, give them the whole menu at 80% off. Have a staff meal each day where a line cook or someone from the back of the house is willing to prepare a family recipe. It costs you nothing, but it'll cost you everything in terms of your business if you don't get it right. So I would say that's number one. And then two is when we're talking about lawyers and accountants, get an accountant in and go through every single line item and ensure you understand it. All right. So don't just say, oh yeah, our cost of goods is 30%. Well, is it 30% on food? Is it 30% blended? Is it 30%? Know the numbers. The data is good reading and the data drives the decision-making, or at least should be driving intelligent decision-making. How much money are you spending on marketing? Everyone thinks they can do marketing for free nowadays because of social media. I'm like, you're going to get out of it what you invest into it, right? So I would say numbers, people first, then know the numbers, and then sit down and have the really good conversations and the real healthy conversations and the fun conversations about the food, all right? And then lastly, I was gonna be like, what's the experience? So what is the stimulus? What are the service mechanics? What is the language? What is the music? Who's in charge of HVAC? Who makes sure that all the bathroom sinks work, right? All the stuff that's very intangible to the guest, but they'll walk away and they'll go, something was off or that wasn't a good experience. So how are you defining the experience and then how are you going to deliver it?
You mentioned the fact that you're in Asia, and I think this would be a great bridge into the Travis Talbot experiment. What is that?
Well, first thing everyone always spits out is like you're on your little bit of your Bourdain walkabout. And it's true, you know, and I was inspired by Anthony Bourdain, as so many of us were. And then go back to what we were talking about earlier. When I had that VP role or multiple VP roles, when I had my own restaurants, when I owned my own nightclubs, and you know this, Josh, like if you have a live entertainment nightclub, you're there 2 p.m. for load-in, then you're there for the green room setup, and then you're there to meet the talent and the artist, then you're there for the show. Then you're there for strike. It can be a 22-hour day, all right? So I got to the point where it's like, okay, I know I'm not going to be a cowboy. I know I don't really have any other calling that I'm interested in pursuing. So I'm going to stay in hospitality. And then I'm like, I need to see more. right? I can't just be the little bubbles that I've been floating around in. I need to see what's out there. So the experiment is, how did the Portuguese, how did they convey hospitality? How did they deliver the restaurant experience? How did the Thai do it? How do, you know, I'm going to Hong Kong next week and I'm looking for the difference between the two things. So it's really an experiment in life and lessons and opening up my eyes to new cultures and bigger things. But then also everywhere I'm going, I'm picking up on the details. I was in Morocco 6 months ago, and everybody there, when you walk into their restaurant, the very first thing they say is, this is your restaurant. This is your home for the next 2 hours. And I'm like, that is a great approach. And then here in Thailand, I've been noticing a lot of the mom-and-pop operators where the very first thing they say is Sawadee Khee. They're like, thank you for being here. They say the thank you at the beginning, as opposed to us North Americans. We're like, thank you. Here's the bill. Pay me and tip me. Where here, that kind of level of hospitality is acknowledged at the beginning. We're gracious for the fact that you've chosen to come into our restaurant. So I'm just picking up on all these little nuances and little touch points from different cultures, in addition to the food. Like tonight, I sat in the kitchen with a bunch of chefs after hours. Like it's almost 3 o'clock where I'm at. And all I did was taste different types of tom yum soup, right? This one's super sour. Oh, that's from the north. Oh, this one's I'm going to be sweating for the next 6 hours, by the way. So that's the experiment, is how is hospitality communicated and conveyed in other cultures? And how can we take that and then apply it and deliver it to our clients to say, hey, because we have so many clients now that want, especially on the resort landscape where they've got up to 25 different F&B outlets and restaurants on a resort landscape, they got to offer some diversity and some different offerings. So we're like, well, okay, if you're going to do Asian, are you going to do it correctly? Right? And because here's some insights as it, or even a couple of years ago, just before the pandemic, everybody was getting heavy into Latin American foods. And I'm like, okay. So I just did a year traveling Mexico. Are you going to do this style of food, or are you just going to do Chipotle, or are you going to invest the time into making a proper mole? And it's just, once again, having a healthy conversation and helping people understand what they don't know, right?
I have one more question for you. The restaurant industry is filled with unspoken rules and traditions about how things should be done. How would you like to see our industry turn the tables to create a better future for all of us?
Oh, that's easy. Kindness. It's the hospitality. One of the questions we ask is, what game do you think you're in? Or what industry do you think you're in? And we'll hear the service industry. I'm like, no, service is part of what you do, but it's not the industry that you're in. Then we're like, we're in food and beverage. I'm like, that's one of the commodities. That's one of the exchanges you're going to do to help support your business. But it's very rare that someone says they're in the hospitality industry. And that goes to whether they're doing catering, cruise ships, hotels. Everyone thinks they're providing a service. I'm like, the very first service you should be providing is hospitality, meaning you're making someone feel welcome in your business or want to be a patron in that business. Then from there, I think hospitality also extends to staff. Once again, we were talking about the culture piece. And you know what? My brother and I have this argument because as a chef, he's very Gordon Ramsay, and I like to consider myself a little bit more Jamie Oliver. And he's now learned over the years is that you'll get way more out of people if they like you, for one. And if you're kind to them, be an educator, be an empowerer, be a mentor. And that'd be one thing. Between the Food Network, between all these celebrity chefs, all these competition shows, and then all the terrible press that came out of the pandemic, like who the fuck would want to work in the hospitality industry? We used to joke, it's like, hey, come join the hostility industry, right? But the perks are good once in a while, very rarely. But if you could change that model or that misconception and change that thinking that kindness counts and kindness is currency, both to your team, to your support workers, and to your guests. So I would like to break that misconception that it's all German chefs throwing clogs at you and every bartender's a drunk that's trying to pick up the hostess. Like, yeah, that's in some environments. But for the most part, if we could just break that kind of ideology and those misconceptions, because there's a lot of good that happens in the hospitality industry.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Travis Talbot. For more information on the chef and his businesses, visit ttexperiment.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Kopel. You've been listening to Full Comp.